Whenever I address them, to look outwards beyond Canada's borders. The fate of women in this country is tied to that of women in the rest of the world. That observation is no less true of women in the media than it is of women in any other walk of life. So my third and final absolute is that equality will not be achieved by any one of us or some of us in isolation, because we are, for better or worse, our sister. Thank you.
That was Rosemary Brown, a Jamaican-Canadian feminist politician, scholar, writer, and organizer, addressing a conference on women in the media in 1991. The piece was originally produced by WING's co-founder, Catherine Davenport. For Black History Month in February 2009, Canada Post issued a stamp honoring Rosemary Brown. Brown passed away April 26, 2003, at the age of 72. Reporting for WINGS, I'm Frieda Worden. Our email is wings@wings.org. Website, www.wings.org. The WINGS sound logo is from Livana's album, A Circle Is Cast. Special thanks to Suzette Cullen and to Genevieve Vaughn, author of 36 Steps Toward a Gift Economy. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.
I am Dr. Demento. I am here in a land of happy, freaky people. KBOO Portland.
Independent media is now more important than ever, and we want to know how KBOO Community Radio can best serve you. KBOO's Board of Directors invites you to a community meeting on Saturday, February 21st at 11:30 a.m. at the Clinton Street Theater and online via public video conference. This is your opportunity to share feedback, offer ideas, and help guide the station's direction. The meeting will be followed by a social hour. That's KBOO Community Radio's community meeting on Saturday, February 21st at 11:30 a.m. at the Clinton Street Theater. For more information, visit kboo.fm/community26.
Good morning, Portland Pollies. This is Dr. Tony Zimbardi, and you are now listening to Radical Romance, the show of, by, and for people in non-traditional relationships. By that I mean either open or polyamorous ones. And today I have a guest that I'll be interviewing named Joss, with a long history of open and poly relationships. I myself have some experience with that, and I'll begin with some of the ethicist columns from the New York Times, which I read basically to get your thoughts stimulated and your opinions about these situations, if you've had them in the past yourself, or if you have wondered about them. So to get right to it, the first column is, Our Thruple Fell Apart, What Are the Rules of the Breakup? Well, I can relate to that. For those of you who are longer-time listeners, back in the fall, my own thruple fell apart. If you may remember, it was myself, my now ex, who I had referred to as Ken Doll, and my now current main squeeze, who was then known as Stanley, who's actually Stuart, and that sort of wrapped up abruptly in October, about 6 months ago. Is that when that was? About 6 months? Yeah, October of 25, and so we're now in 26, and I'm happy with the ultimate outcome, which is I'm now with Stuart, and he's a wonderful guy. Shout out to you, Stuart. I don't know if you heard that. That was a little kiss on Elk. So anyway, here is the Our Thruple Fell Apart, What Are the Rules of the Breakup? From the New York Times ethicist. And it goes on, the writer goes on to say, nearly a year ago, I began dating two friends. I'll call them Rachel and Dave. I don't know if this is a male or female writing this. Well, we may come to find out soon enough. They were already themselves in a relationship. We all had no experience with polyamory. The trouble ended fairly quickly with no one being at fault. The other two continued to date but broke up not too long afterward. Since then, Rachel and Dave have dated on and off. Rachel and I were casually together, and Dave and I have been close friends who sleep together occasionally. Turn the page. There are relationships with others outside the group. At times, we have all behaved badly, sleeping together behind each other's backs, knowing the knowledge would hurt the other. Strong emotions, love, and pain have arisen on all sides. Throughout the past year, as a multiple complex situations arose, we have all wished for a model of behavior. Monogamy-centered media suggests that one should avoid dating a friend's ex-partner. Is this correct? And if so, can this concept be universalized? Do Rachel and Dave get priority in that they should be together and I should not pursue either because they dated first? What do we do to our romantic partners and friends when the situations are complex, names withheld? And the ethicist replies, in love and sex, as in other matters, the patterns that work for the many may not work for the few. Even if there were established rules about whether it's okay to date a friend's ex-lover or even an ex-lover's friend, it could be obvious how to apply them when your ex-lover's friend was also your friend's ex-lover. This is confusing. I doubt bro code logic will help you in this sort of arrangement. Instead of universalizing norms like these, try to understand their rationale when it comes to dating someone your friend has recently broken up with. The norm was always a yellow light rather than a red light, and there are plausible rationales for exercising caution. There should well be unresolved feelings between the two of, for instance, Rachel and Dave, on and off again, their open relationship, or a friend could feel awkwardly that the ex is comparing them with you, isn't a specific rule. It's the idea of having brunch together, what's universally applicable, isn't a specific rule. So that's the ethicist feedback on that. Any comments or question on when your thruple has fallen apart? 503-231-8187. I'm interested in hearing what you have to say about that. If you have been in a thruple that fell apart, please give me a call. Let me know if yours ended any better than mine. But in the end, I'm very happy with my outcome. So let's go on to the next. New York Times. Can I tell a member of my church that I recognize him from a dating app? This is kind of juicy. I am a part of a faith community that does not affirm same-sex relationships, and I plan to continue following the teaching even though I am bisexual. I do not know many others in the same situation. A few years ago, while exploring my sexuality online, the writer goes on to say, I came across a man from the same faith community on a dating app. I'm not sure if he noticed me, and I quickly blocked him. He is now engaged to a woman. I have thought about reaching out to him, and I am unaware and unsure how to do so without making it intrusive. At the same time, it would mean a lot to have someone I would relate to in this area. Okay, so it's getting a little better. Now he's looking sort of for a comrade. Would it be appropriate to make contact, or would I cross a line? So let's see how the New York Times ethicist responds. Page 2 here. the implicit norms associated with such apps do not amount to contact me whenever and wherever you wish. Probably they tilt towards don't act like you know me if you see me at Costco. There are differences between facilitating intimacy and conferring acquaintance. If you tell this person you recognize him from the app, however, begin your intentions, he may feel exposed, vulnerable, and dependent on your discretion in a community that frowns on same-sex relationships. You yourself might too. That could make him uneasy. You should also ask yourself why you want to be in touch. Given that the other person is engaged, he's most likely committed, as you are, to abstaining from same-sex relationships. So I think what amounts is exactly what you're hoping to discuss and hoping to gain. The adults in your community are already familiar with the problem of sexual attraction to people, regardless of sexual orientation, and to those whom with sex might be permissible, such as an attraction to someone who's already married. You don't need a bisexual interlocutor to discuss forbidden desires, then, and discussing erotic temptation. It's not necessarily a good thing, and trying to manage that. He wraps up saying, still, there is another way conversation with this person might go. It might lead you both to discuss whether you're right to adhere to this teaching. So I get the ethicist point. It's about seeing if it facilitates a dialogue, the initiating conversation about seeing each other on a dating app, and whether or not this faith community, which doesn't approve of same-sex relationships, is right for either one of these guys. Clearly one is very closeted. He's about to marry a woman, despite the fact that he was on a gay dating app, and the reader here is just your run-of-the-mill gay man, it sounds like. So anyway, if you have any thoughts about this, please call in 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. This is Dr. Tony Zimbardi. You're listening to Radical Romance. And let's see, here's one more. The headline is, I was bullied for being gay. Why didn't my parents do more to help? So that's very interesting. And anyway, it starts off with, I'm a gay man in my 50s and comfortable in my skin, but I suffered severe bullying throughout school. A recent class reunion prompted me to write a tell-all letter to the current school director regarding that trauma. His gracious response was incredibly healing. My family has accepted me since I came out in my 20s, but they don't know the full extent of my past ordeal. Okay, so this is a guy who was bullied terribly as a kid. Let's see. Well, I shared the letter with my supportive brother. I've hesitated to show my parents, who are now in their 70s. They claim ignorance. We didn't know you were gay. You never told us you were gay. Yet they openly acknowledge I was different ever since toddlerhood, and they often criticize my unboyish behavior while growing up. Oh, I have some of this in my own past history. This is a little painful to think about and read. Older kids called me a gay slur. Well, we all know what that is. The Brits refer to it as a cigarette, another word, three-letter word that starts with F and ends with G, or O-T-T. Anyway, since writing to the school, I feel an urge to finally have a warts and all talk with my parents to understand their perspective. Should I open a Pandora's box with them now, or leave things for the sake of family peace, how would I even approach such a conversation? So the response is, I can imagine how healing it felt to be met with compassion when you shared your experience with the school's director. After many years of silence, it makes sense that his gracious acknowledgement meant so much to you. The question now is whether approaching your parents will bring similar healing. To answer this, you'll need to sit with three questions. Number one, what am I hoping for? What happens if I don't get it? And who is this conversation really for? The younger version of me or the adult version? The first question, you say that your goal with your parents would be to understand their perspective, but I have a feeling that what you want most is for them to understand yours. That's what felt so gratifying after you wrote to the school's director. You weren't asking why he tolerated the bullying, whether he knew you were gay, and how he thought about the sexual orientation after 40 years. After all, he wasn't there. You were simply saying, here's what happened to me. The interaction didn't feel healing because you understood the perspective. It was what he saw and honored your pain. Your parents, on the other hand, were there during your childhood, and I'm guessing a part of you is still angry with them, for there are ways and things you needed. So perhaps you still wanted to acknowledge that you were gay as a child and that you were bullied mercilessly for it, and to apologize for ignoring your struggle. If that's the case, move to the second question. What if you don't get that? In the past, they've denied knowing that you were gay and suffering. How will you feel if they maintain their position and continue to tell themselves they weren't aware? I say tell themselves because that's what they probably did. Your mother's shock and horror about your being gay and hearing the gay slur was likely fear, not ignorance, regarding the bullies at school, but from a world that might hurt you physically, emotionally, and freshly throughout your life. Maybe in that time and place there weren't even a fear of how a gay family member might affect the neighbors and bosses and social ties and treat all of you, including your mother and your brother. In this sense, we didn't know might be less than a form of protective denial that families sometimes develop around uncomfortable truths they don't know how to handle, and it might be your parents' way of coping with the fact that a tiny part of them knows how, despite how much they loved you, they still let you down. So you ask yourself, if you don't get what you want, is there value in even bringing this up anyway? Excellent answer. I don't think I ever asked my parents about that, despite the fact that I was really bullied as a kid. And most gay folks that I know, certainly in my generation, knew they were gay even as children. I know I used to watch Batman and Superman and all those superheroes with muscles and tights. I knew there was something I was really drawn to as a kid. And then, of course, back in the day, that show with Robert Conrad, Wild Wild West, where he wore those tight little bolero outfits, the tight pants and the little jackets, and I thought that was the sexiest thing. Even as a child, I knew there was something about him that it had a sexuality about it. It was meant to emphasize his masculinity, and I was terribly drawn to that. You're shaking your head, Josh. Josh is my guest today. Why don't we just get right into that? And if you have any questions about any of the ethicist columns I read, please give us a call, 503-231-8187. Okay, I'm going to get into it with Joss. So tell me, Joss, what is your story?
You mean in terms of what we were just talking about, or?
Yes.
Well, certainly the same thing happened to me when I was a child, that I would watch Batman and Robin, who not only, you know, ran around in little tights, but were getting tied up. And I didn't connect it with sex or sexuality because I was too young. I was still, you know, in elementary school. But I knew there was something about it I liked that I did not get the same reaction watching women on TV. You know, if a man and a woman are running along the beach and she's in a bikini and he's in little shorts, you know, I would look at the man like, wow, there's something about that I like. And I would not get the reaction, you know, looking at the woman.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay, so now let's forward to you're an adult. Mm-hmm. Tell me a little bit about some of your history in terms of open or polyamorous relationships.
I hardly know where to begin. I mean, I've always felt like you could, I have to be careful how I say this, separate sex and love, that they weren't synonymous. I think people can, you know, they date someone, whether you're gay or straight or bi or anything, you know, you can date someone and, you know, and then you end up in the sack and you have this wonderful time and thought, oh my gosh, this must be love. And I think I always had a sense that, well, it was really great and I'd sure like to see this person more, but I know that's not love. You know, it might be infatuation, but it's not love per se.
But it was the erotic encounter that was what stood most in your memory about the experience?
I mean, I could be dating them too. I mean, sometimes it was casual sex and sometimes it was more like dating. Mm-hmm. But I still knew, okay, you had three great dates. That's not love yet. It may be.
Well, it's sort of the difference between the culture and how we're all raised that sex and love are synonymous, and you're going to grow up, you're going to fall in love, you're going to get into a relationship, you're going to be having sex, as opposed to then we come out as gay men and we realize, oh, that's not the way the gay community works. For many gay men, and there were times where I certainly went through this, I think sex is seen as sport or a hobby almost, something to do in your spare time for fun. Is that your experience, or?
I think mostly so, yeah. It's the whole, there's a writer named Lola Davina, and I don't know if she came up with this quotation or she was just repeating it, but she said there's this myth that's especially perpetuated by Hollywood that, you know, you meet someone and you fall in love and you get married and you stay in love with them the rest of your life and you have some kids and that's it. There's a single person in the entire world for you, and that's it. And she disagreed strongly with that. I mean, beyond the fact, you know, that people get divorced or break up, that's not the only, what am I trying to say here?
Well,
outcome for everybody's life.
Yeah, it's sort of a standard outcome we're all presented with, I think, by our larger culture. And then we become sexual beings and we realize, well, that doesn't necessarily apply 100% of the time. In fact, not even 80% of the time, probably. So, yes, again, going back to in the gay community in particular, the separation between sex and love. And it's really wonderful when they come together. I'm in a relationship now where, for me, they come together. And can you speak more to your experience of when they did not come together? Or maybe you had someone you loved with and didn't necessarily have a strong erotic connection with, and that would cause you to seek outside experiences?
I had a friend who was in a relationship, a monogamous relationship. And this friend was very attractive, but I knew from the start, okay, monogamous relationship, you're just going to be friends. And as we became very good friends, and as that happened, I began having feelings for this person. And I kept thinking, okay, just put that out of your mind. That's not going to happen. You're just going to make things awkward for everybody. And friends of mine were saying, oh, just jump his bones someday. I said, but that's not what I think about. It's not that he wasn't attractive or sexy, but I wasn't sitting at home, oh yeah, babe, thinking about, you know, this guy. And finally, I couldn't stand it anymore. There was that scene in Love Actually where the guy was in love with his best friend's wife and he tried to put it out of his mind. And finally, did you see the film?
I did, but I don't remember much.
There's a scene where he was supposed to visit them on Christmas or something, and he comes to the door, and she answers it, and he has these signs. And he says, you know, I just want to tell you that I'm absolutely crazy about you, but I understand that there's nothing to be done about it, and I don't want to make it difficult for you or for my friend, but I just had to say it, and now I'm going to let it go. And so that's basically what happened with me and this friend here. I said, okay, I have to tell you something. And he was really very cool with it. And after that, I think the not telling him made it more intense, if that makes sense. That once I had told him and he had heard it and hadn't freaked out, it was like, oh, okay, now we can go back to just being friends, and I'm not sitting here like, oh, I love this guy, I love this guy. So, if that makes sense.
So, did you love that guy, or did you have a romantic fantasy about him?
I don't know. This is a while ago. I'm really not sure. I mean, I didn't picture us settling down or getting married. I just had a very strong feeling for him. I think he understood me in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm.
And
I'm curious, were either one of you already in a relationship with someone else?
Oh, he was in a monogamous gay relationship.
Oh, okay. Okay.
So, which is why I didn't want to do anything about this. Like, just put it out of your head. Just be friends. There you go, you know.
Well, the two of you obviously moved beyond that at some point, beyond your feelings. But how did he respond? Did he say the usual, well, I'm flattered? And
yes. He said he was really flattered and he was concerned about me. He said, if hanging out with me is making you feel awkward, you know, we can take a break or I can, you know. And I said, well, let's just see how this goes. You know, I really don't want to take a break. What happened was we were getting together once a week to watch a series of movies because we were part of this online group that discussed these movies. Mm-hmm. And so he's like, so we would take turns going to each other's house. We'd have dinner, we'd watch the movie, and then we'd, you know, go online and discuss it.
And sounds so fun.
Yeah, it was.
Sounds like a nice, intimate friendship.
But yeah, after I told him, he said, you know, we can step back or I can bow out of the picture if it's making you uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. I said, well, let's just see how this goes. But again, after telling him, it just was such a relief off my mind that after that, I mean, I still had affection for him, but I wasn't sitting there, you know, with my heart thumping in my chest, boom, 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 oh my gosh, oh my gosh. So.
How did it go after that?
It went fine. We just kept doing what we were doing, you know, getting together and watching the movies. And, you know, we got together other times too, to, you know, go out for lunch or something.
So you moved beyond
Right. Your
feelings.
Right.
What eventually was the outcome? Did you meet someone else at some point, or he stayed in his relationship and it just progressed?
He stayed in his relationship. And it wasn't like I wasn't dating other people. It wasn't like, okay, I love this guy, I'm just going to stop seeing anybody else. That wasn't the case at all. And I wasn't, oh, I have to have a boyfriend now. I have to have a boyfriend. You know, I'm on the hunt for a boyfriend. It wasn't like that. It just, I don't know if I answered your question.
Well, actually, in your answer, it made me think I should ask you more about your current love life.
Mm-hmm.
What is that like? You are married now
right.
to a man?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
We've been married about 5.5 years now, I think.
Mm-hmm. And how long have you been together overall?
We're coming up on our 11th anniversary.
Mm-hmm. Nice. Congratulations.
Thank you. And I just adore this person. He's, you know, wonderful. And I can't imagine life without him. And
nice.
I remember before I had moved in with him, he was doing some work in his garage and wanted me to help him. And so I would go over regularly and we would put up shelves or paint or something like this.
Uh-huh.
And one day he was on one side of the garage doing something and I was, I don't know, mixing paint. And I just happened to look at him and I thought, you know, I could see myself building a life with this guy.
Hmm.
You know, it just came mm-hmm. to me like that. And it was nice because it didn't feel like, oh my gosh, I have to get married. I have to find a boyfriend. It was just, that's just how the universe presented it to me.
Let's get into the nitty-gritty now of monogamy versus non-monogamy.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of a relationship do you have now with this person? His name is Clarence, right?
Right. We have an open relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a few rules about it, but it's never been a big issue. I think there was one time where he got a little jealous about someone I was seeing, and this wasn't this other person I was seeing. It wasn't like a polyamorous thing, like I was in love with that guy too.
Uh-huh.
It was, we were friends with benefits, and he felt a little jealous about it. And I said, well, I'm happy to stop seeing him, but I want to reassure you that I always come home to you. You know, I don't sit there thinking, ooh, if I could just get rid of this one, I could go with the other guys. And not at all.
I think that's the important thing. I wrote an article on that topic years ago when I lived in Los Angeles in one of the gay rags there, all about monogamy versus non-monogamy. And I think the most important thing in a non-monogamous relationship is reassuring the partner exactly what you just said, that I will always pick you as the one who's my center, my grounding place, my person, no matter who I enjoy sexually, physically, in my spare time. And that was a very popular article. People really seemed to respond to that. I will always pick you first. And I still sort of go by that rule, which is, I think it's a good thing that you will always pick your partner first. And
mm-hmm.
no matter what other playtime you may have. I've talked about it before, but I know Stuart and his former deceased husband had a relationship that was physically non-monogamous, but emotionally monogamous. So don't fall in love with somebody, but by all means go and have sex with them if you like.
Mm-hmm.
And that's sort of how I like to lead my current relationship with him. So tell me a little bit more about these experiences you've had since getting together with Clarence.
Other experiences with, you mean with people outside the relationship?
Or? Yes.
It's, you know, I have online profiles and, you know, I spell it out right there. You know, before you read any further, I am married, you know. He's my baby, and I can play. We don't do three ways, but I can play. And then just so that people reading it, you know, if they're looking to date somebody seriously or looking for, you know, husband material, it's like, okay, that's not me. Thank you, but that's not me.
Why do you tell them you don't do three ways?
Because we don't. we're just wired a little differently. And I've been in... Certainly, I've done three ways or more, but it's funny how you get the feeling that one of the other two, like say it's a couple, kind of agreed begrudgingly to it, because they say, okay, you know, we're a couple, we want to do a three-way. It's like, okay, come on over. And then one guy's all hot to trot and you're just doing it, and the other guy's just sort of leaning back like, I guess I agreed to this. And it's
yes, we've all been in that situation,
right?
I mentioned to you I'd read last time from the ethicist about the using an AI picture online, which is a glamorized version of your true self.
Mm-hmm.
And how many people, we were talking earlier, may use a picture that's 25 or 30 years younger than what they are now. And then you meet them and you look at them and you think, why don't you look like your picture? What's going on here? I did have a personal experience with that maybe 30 years ago. I was in a relationship with a partner and we had arranged for someone to come over for a three-way encounter, and the person got to the house, walked in the front door, and we're all still standing in the living room. And my partner says to this gent, you know, you don't look anything like your picture. And the guy looks a little embarrassed. And my partner says to him, You know what? I like taking photographs of people. I like portraits. I'll take a nude picture for you. Do you want to do it right now? I'm sure I could snap a picture and you'd have a much better version of what you've got going online. And the guy says, oh, no, that's okay. That's okay. And my partner goes on to say, no, really, or you can come back another time and I'll take your picture. And I could see that this guy was getting more and more uncomfortable as my partner kept pressing him for a new picture. And eventually, we all decided it wasn't a good idea to get together physically. Mm-hmm. And the guy left. But I think he was feeling so embarrassed, maybe humiliated by the, I'll call it a confrontation now, but by the experience of having someone repeatedly tell them, dude, you look nothing like your picture. What's going on? You should have a new one, and I'll even take a new one. And in that case, it just didn't work out, and the guy left, and we just went to bed. But that's the risk everyone takes of putting pictures of themselves online. Make sure if you're posting a pic of yourself online that it's a reasonable facsimile of yourself. If anybody has any thoughts, please give us a call, 503-231-8187. So we're talking about open relationships, non-monogamy, polyamory, and using accurate pictures online if you're hooking up. Any more thoughts?
I mean, I've met people who, I don't even know if it was, the picture was even them. They were so radically different. Yeah. And I feel like it's just kind of an insecurity. I mean, you know, most people have some insecurity about their looks or their weight or anything. But you want to meet people who are going to accept you for that or don't care about that. Well, gee, I'm kind of heavy. I don't care. I think you're sexy anyway, so your weight doesn't matter to me. So you don't need to post a picture of you when you were, you know, 22 and weighed 100 pounds.
Yeah, even on Facebook, I have some personal friends who use pictures that I know are probably 25 years old, and I'm thinking, why is so-and-so posting that pic of themselves? I mean, yeah, it was when they were young and cute, but guess what? They're not so young and cute anymore, but they're still using that pic. Why? It's just Facebook. What difference does it make? So anyway, give us a call if you have any specific thoughts. 503-231-8187. You're listening to KBOO, KBOO 90.7 on your FM dial. And this is Dr. Tony Zimbardi, Radical Romance, here with my guest today, Joss. So tell us some more stories, Joss, about
Gosh. It's, since we're talking about looks, before the internet, there was something called a BBS, bulletin board service, and which was like a very crude version of the internet. I don't know if your listeners even know what that means.
Almost like personal ads online.
Right, exactly. And very limited. Some BBSs did not have a way to upload photos. So it was just text. Hi, my name is Frank. I'm 35. Uh-huh. I'm looking for this, whatever. So I was talking to this guy, and we decided, I said, well, you know, why don't you come over sometime and we can play? And he said, well, you know, I'm much older than you. And I don't even think he was that much older, maybe 15 years or so. And I said, it's not an issue. And he said, well, I've had people, as soon as they find out my age, they just shut the conversation down. And I said, I don't think I wouldn't worry about it. So the day came, and my door did not have a peephole. There was no way to look out the thing. And I'm sitting there waiting for this guy, and I thought, gee, he was awfully insecure about his age. I said, oh, what am I going to do if he's like a total dog or something? And so knock, knock, the door open. The door knocks. I open it. And this guy looked like a young Peter Gallagher. He did not look his age at all. And he had told me, and so, you know, we had a very nice time.
Peter Gallagher was quite handsome in his youth.
He still is handsome, but yeah. He was quite the stunner when he was, you know, in his 20s.
Yep.
And this guy was saying, you know, so we had our fun and we were just chit-chatting, and he said something about his daughter's graduation. I said, oh, that's cute. Little kindergarten kids have a graduation. He goes, she's not in kindergarten. She's going to college next week. Because he looked so much younger than his age. Mm-hmm. And I said, you know, anybody who's canceling on you because of your age. They said, they're fools. They don't know what they're missing.
Did he ever tell you what his age was?
Yeah, he did. But I don't remember. Again, I don't remember how much older he was, but 15, 20 years older. And he looked like a young Peter Gallagher. He looked much younger than his
age. So he was a good-looking man of a certain age.
Absolutely.
Well, good for him.
Yeah.
Okay. So in your history, do you have any experiences with professional sex encounters? I don't know how else to put that.
Oh, you mean like, did I go see a sex worker or something like that?
Or were you a sex worker?
Or did you mean like on the job? I was at work and had sex with somebody at work.
No, because we've all done that from time to time. But I guess most of my guests, have you ever been paid for sex? And that's one of the big ethicist columns as well. People always write in asking, should I tell my current partner about my past history? And so anything juicy in your past history you can tell us about?
I was a sex worker for a while.
Uh-huh.
And I gave it a lot of thought before I did it.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't just stick up an ad and say, hey, come on over. And I thought, what am I willing to do or not do? And draw that line so that if someone comes over saying, I expect this, I expect that, well, my ad says I do this and I don't do that. And I think it really, sorry, I was going somewhere with this and I forgot now. I'm sorry, it's gone.
Well, did you at any point tell Clarence about this experience?
He knew.
So you did.
Right. And his concern was because I don't know if I want to go there. No, he knew, and he was fine with it. He was very, I don't want to say supportive, that's maybe the wrong word, but...
Accepting?
Accepting, yes, let's say. There was a guy I had dated for a while, and as dating, it didn't work out, so we just became friends. And he had been doing a lot of travel, so I had lost touch with him. So I'm in a restaurant one day, and he comes up. He's like, hey, how's it going? What you doing? Watching all this. And I thought, I don't want to lie. Oh, I'm working at the Walmart down the road or something. So I told him what I did. And he was a very hyper guy, made a lot of jokes about things. So I thought, boy, this is going to not go well. So I told him, I said, well, you know, this is what I do now. And all of a sudden he just froze and looked at me. And I thought, here it comes. And he leaned in, please just be very careful. And I just thought that was the sweetest thing because I was expecting the opposite reaction. So
tell me again the context. He was a former...
He was just somebody I had dated. And we became friends. Or we ended up being friends.
But not a former client.
No, he was not a client, no.
Well, yeah, those are pretty common in our community, running into past people we've hooked up with. That's why it's good to move 1,000 miles away from anybody you know, such as I did a few years ago.
Mm-hmm.
You never run into people on the street who've had any sort of past history with, which encounters, like you just said,
right,
naturally happen in our community, the gay men's community for sure, because we've all been around the block. In fact, that was the biggest compliment I ever got as a therapist, was I had this gay man who came in for his very first visit, and we spoke for the standard 50 minutes. I asked him all of my standard intake questions. And then I asked him at the end of the session, what he thought about coming back. And he said, you know, we spoke for almost an hour. You said absolutely nothing about yourself. So, he said, I just got the impression that you've been around the block. So yes, I'll come back because of that.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't know what the hell I said in that session, but anyway, he saw me for a long time after that, and I think I helped him. I hope I helped him. So let me see. We're running through the hour. If we have any callers, 503-231-8187. If you're listening and if you have any thoughts or questions for me or Joss, please give us a call and let us know. So back to you, Joss.
It was one thing I did that I prided myself in my work was that this was, the work I did was, let's just say, educational. It wasn't, you know, if you just want to have intercourse or just sex, I'm not the person for that. You know, what I was doing was more mentoring, let's say. And I emphasized to my clients that this isn't my excuse. This isn't my way of getting my rocks off. You know, I'm not just using my clients so I can have a good time. This is not about me at all. And so, and I think they appreciated that because they knew here's someone who's going to actually do his job of being a mentor or an educator and not just, and so they knew I was serious about it, you know.
A mentor implies you have more experience than the other individual and you have something to offer them. So what were you offering them, those particular kind of clients?
I was a mentor for, I guess I can say BDSM. I was a mentor for BDSM. And my elevator speech was, if this is something you're curious about, but you've been kind of reluctant to say go to a leather bar and go home with someone, or just answer some random ad, here you can ask me questions. I can show you how things are done, and it's for your education. And so again, it isn't about, you know, me getting my jollies. And I kept a blog at the time where I would write about, not about clients, oh yeah, guess who came over last week, but if you're interested in this kind of activity, here's what you need to be aware of to stay safe and to do it, you know, properly without injuring yourself or injuring somebody else, and what to do if something goes wrong. And I think I got clients that way because they would read it and say, oh, here's someone who knows what he's talking about. He's not just saying, oh yeah, I'll do this to you and there you go, you know.
The intellectual dom.
Yes.
Lessons for the faint of heart.
And, you know, I emphasized discretion. I said, you know, what happens here is just between you and me. And I'm unshockable. I may not be able to teach you everything. You know, I may say, well, that's outside my field. Maybe go see this person. But you can tell me anyway, you know.
What happens in Southeast stays in Southeast, whatever. Oh, cute, cute. So how interesting. How long did you do that for?
About 5 years.
Sounds fun. And did you offer these folks a reasonable price, or was it affordable to people with little experience? I'm curious.
I did my homework. I went online to see what other people were charging, all the way from masseurs to, you know, the high class escorts and everything in between, and thought, okay, this is about what I think I can reasonably charge. And it's some of these escorts, you know, $600,000-$700,000 an hour. And I thought, wow, that's, you know, good for you.
I had a friend, well, he passed, who in his final year decided he would hire escorts to fulfill every one of his unfulfilled sexual fantasies. And he told me he was paying people $1,000 a visit to provide him with specific fantasies. Yeah, so I guess there's money to be made there, but it sounds like you were very mindful.
Right, because I really did not want people leaving feeling like this guy just took advantage of me. I gave him this money and then he got his jollies and then, you know. And so it was always their education, their pleasure first. And I think they appreciated that.
Nice, nice. I like it. Now you're the mindful dom. The mindful mentor dom, Joss. So if you have any questions for Joss, please give us a call, 503-231-8187. It's a quiet morning here in Portland.
I guess I'm not salacious enough.
Well, you are. I don't think you've said anything that's going to upset anyone today. But if you feel like saying something salacious, go ahead and say it. Just be clinical about it.
Right.
That's all
right.
I have to say.
I know dead air is a bad thing. I'm trying to think of something.
What's your relationship like with Clarence now? Do you still occasionally connect with guys for fun or other activities?
You know, we moved to Portland just immediately after COVID, the first COVID case, which was kind of upsetting because we came here for a new life and let's make some new friends and all this. Oh, we can't do anything. We can't go out. We can't talk to people. We certainly can't, you know, whatever. And so, so for a couple of years, it was just, we just didn't think about it.
I moved to Portland just before COVID. I moved here in December of 19, and then in March of 20, the whole world shut down and everything changed. I would invite everyone I met to come over and have a drink and let's sit on my balcony, which is great. I have an 18th floor balcony, some of the best views in Portland, and that's how I made friends. Mm-hmm. I'm like, we don't have to wear our masks because we're outside. We can just talk, hang out, and chill just like normal friends. And that's how I met friends and made them. And it worked for me. But yeah, that was a tough time to move here for both of us. And for anybody else who moved here around the time of COVID. Yeah, a little scary. Because you didn't know, you couldn't see it. At least with HIV, I mean, you can't see it, but you know it's there. So people during that period participated in safer sexual activities. Now, what I hear from the youngsters is it's a non-issue for them. They're all on PrEP, and so HIV seems to be a non-issue. Some of them, in fact, want an HIV-positive partner because they don't have to worry about it, because they've shared with me that they know that positive person is on the same medications that they are, basically, for PrEP. So it feels like a double protection for them. So they feel like they can do anything they want with a positive person because they aren't worried that there's going to be an exposure to the virus. Mm-hmm. If you have any thoughts about that, give us a call, 503-231-8187. You're listening to Radical Romance. This is Dr. Tony Zimbardi, and I'm here today talking with Joss, my guest.
There was a gentleman had come to me for my services, and he was straight or mostly straight, a little bi. Mm-hmm. And he said, you know, I see gay guys doing this and that, and they seem to enjoy it, so I'd like to give it a try, but, and you seem like the person to do it, that you're gentle and patient and all this. And so we were in the middle of this, and everything was getting very hot and steamy, and he was, you know, making all these noises. And all of a sudden he just stops and looks at me and goes, people really pay you for this? Yes. You know, can we get back to what we were doing? It really is like any other job that I'm sure people think, oh, it's so easy. You just lay back and let it be done. Or, you know, you just have sex and people shower you with cash. And it's not like that. It's like any job, whether you're working at McDonald's or you're working in an office or you're doing sex work. There are things about it you really like and things about it you don't like. Some of it's easy, some of it not so easy. And so, you know, whenever I hear people say, oh, it's got to be easy, and it's like, yeah, I'd like to see you try it.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
What were the parts about that that you did not like? I'm curious now.
One of the hardest things was it's not a word of mouth kind of occupation. Mm-hmm. You know, someone does carpentry work on your house, you'll tell your friends, yeah, so-and-so came over and built me a new deck, and oh, they are great, and here's their card, you should call them. But no one goes back to work on Monday, hey, guess what? I hired this guy to me over the weekend. You should give him a try. And so it was difficult to, you know, find clients in the first place and hope that they would be repeat clients. And then when Sesta Fosta came up, that gutted.
When what came up?
I can't remember what they stood for. These were bills that were signed into law by our current president in his previous administration. And ostensibly, they were to protect people from being victims of sex trafficking, which is a good thing. You don't want sex trafficking. But it was very wide-reaching, and there was opposition to this by other lawmakers. Things like, if you're a sex worker and you're in a mall and you're picking up a client that way, the mall can now be held liable for sex trafficking because you were in that mall.
Interesting.
And but unfortunately, they got signed into the thing. And so a lot of websites like Craigslist cut their personals. Well, we don't want to be accused of sex trafficking, so no more personals.
Interesting. And, I know this is not a political show, but from the man who was best friends with Jeffrey Epstein.
Yeah.
We'll leave it at that. Okay, it's just about time for me to say goodbye. Joss, thank you for your participation today. I really appreciate your coming in and sharing your experience.
Thank you.
It was great. And to all of you who've listened, happy playing. I'll see you the fourth Wednesday of this month.
And maybe I didn't treat you quite as good as I should have. If I made you feel second best,
you did, you did.
Girl, I'm sorry I was blind. You were always on my mind. You were always. Maybe I didn't hold you all those lonely, lonely times. I guess I never told you I'm so happy that you're mine. Little things I should have said. You were always on my mind. You were always on my mind. Tell me that your sweet love hasn't died. And give me. Give me one more chance to keep you satisfied. I'll keep you satisfied. You were all
You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. The time is 10:59 a.m. Next up is The Dirtbag.
KBOO Portland 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934.